Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon channel, where I get to join with creators and mega fans and talk about characters that don't often get the focus that they could or should or deserve. Oh, it deserves an interesting word when we talk about a character like Shinobi Shah, but we're doing the Pride Month special this month on the show, so we get to do an LGBT character each week. This is Shinobi Shah, who I consider bisexual, so we're putting him into that chaotic bisexual category, although we will let his recent creator, Alyssa Wong, determined that once and for all, I suppose, as the most recent writer of Shinobi Shah. What a genuine honor and joy to have Alyssa here with me today. Alyssa, you may know from their work on so many incredible titles, most recently, the incredible book, Psylocke. It was a pleasure to have Alyssa on the show a few months back talking about that with Leah. Alyssa, welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane this morning.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
How are you in June 2025? It's a crazy time in our country.
It is a crazy time. I'm exhausted, I think is probably the best way to put it. But one way that I've been battling my exhaustion has been making things for my friends. So I've been going to a lot of conventions, recently went to a Star Wars convention, and people keep giving me these beaded bracelets, like the Taylor Swift style cute beaded bracelets. And so I realized that I have too many put on one arm, so I had to wear them on both arms at the convention. So I was like, I want to make some for my friends. And that's been a really nice, chill kind of activity that I can do while thinking about story or even just thinking about nothing, which has been fantastic.
That is a wonderful thing. I feel like I always have like a story brimming in the back of my brain somewhere. And when I'm walking, that's when some people say they get inspiration in the shower, but when I'm walking or doing something mindless, my brain is always working on some sort of details. I'm a therapist by trade, so I have to turn that part of my brain off when I'm doing therapy because otherwise that's not a good division when I'm focused on other people. But like when I'm playing games with the kids or whatever, I'm like, oh, I gotta go write this down. Hang on, I'll be right back. I know what that feeling is like. It's a crazy time these days. I keep talking about in therapy sessions the art of dissociation, how we are all just surviving by pretending things are fine, and like that's we're doing our best to get by, and here we are.
I love the term the art of dissociation. That is very real. And so it's this combination, I think, of looking at the world and thinking, I have to get things done and I have to be on it. I have to help my friends. I have to organize. I have to, but also you have to rest, like not just your body, but also your mind. So sometimes you just gotta zone and make bracelets or take a walk and think about story.
I feel like that's what they want. They want us to dissociate and shut down. So creating even the show, writing stories, promoting, pushing people forward, giving narrative to things, I think is an act of defiance in an odd way. And we'll see how that gets redefined in the coming years. But I think it's so important to not lose our joy, even though we gotta just lay down and rest sometimes. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an intense time to put it lightly. And so sometimes for me, I think about the work that I do. I think I'm just out here writing my silly little stories. What am I doing? But something that I've been really touched about is that people will sometimes come to me and say, "Your work means everything to me. Your work I got this really beautiful letter from someone saying, your work saved my life." And that was very intense. A huge honor, and very intense. And so I think about the kind of impact that these stories have outside of myself sometimes. And it's never planned that way because a lot of the time for me, these stories are also for me like an act of survival. I write about the things that I'm thinking about both consciously and subconsciously. It's a fun puzzle to figure out a story, but also everything that you've been thinking about, everything that's been building in your brain, it's this avenue to build that out and to explore it through people who are not you. So, yeah.
I've had that same experience. I wrote a memoir and I've produced a couple of other works, and I've had people who've read my book who've reached out like this super helped. It saved my life. Like that's a humbling thing. Leah and I were both at the Uncanny Experience last year, and I think Leah was super nervous about interacting with a lot of X-Men fans. This is a super X-Men convention, and I got to know her pretty well through the show already, but we hung out in person that day, and I watched a few, several people walk over and talk about like how much X-Factor meant and how much representation meant, and Leah just kind of melted a little bit. And I walked over and I was like, I know you were nervous to come here, but I hope the feeling you're leaving with is like you're still going to be having these experiences like 40 years from now. There are still going to be people walking up and saying that book that you wrote about those queer characters gave me hope. And Alyssa, it's the same for you. You're putting so much representation and storytelling in. It's interesting though, this subconscious of storytelling. At this point, when this comes out, I just put out a one-page story for Pride Month. My friend Seth Martell and I drew a little story about the character Gray Malkin from the X-Men. And I wrote a little one-pager about he and his boyfriend deciding like the mutant affairs are too complicated, and they moved to like Subterranea. They're like, we are accustomed to the shadow. This is where we thrive. I am gonna go to a new place and build a new space, and we're gonna live down here. And it's this cute little story. And when I finished, I was like, oh my God, everyone's leaving the country and everyone's going somewhere else. Like, I didn't even realize what I was channeling when I was writing this little tiny thing. I'm sure you have moments like that all the time in your writing where something works itself out through your characters.
Oh, absolutely. I think I was thinking about themes in my writing, and one thing I've discovered that I write a lot is angry 15-year-old girls, and I don't know why. But I think that in actuality, something that I find myself writing about is people who are afraid to connect with other people because they're scared of themselves. And you see that in Deadpool, you see that in Psylocke, you see that in Dr. Aphra. It's this really intense but intriguing thing that I'm always thinking about. You know, why are we scared of ourselves? What are the stories that people have told us, and why we should be afraid of ourselves? And how true are those stories? Another thing that I found myself writing about a lot is they're often like a sort of angel and devil on your shoulder characters. Well, Psylocke's a great example because she has Grave Crow, who's like, I believe in you. You can be the person that you want to be. People have told you you're just a weapon, but you're so much more than that. And I know that you can be the person that you dream of rather than the person you're afraid of. And then Shinobi Shaw, on the other hand, is like, I don't know. I think it's great that you kill people. I think it's hot. I think it's exciting. Why are you scared of that?
You know, a theme I notice in your writing, though, Alyssa, and if we're just talking Deadpool and Psylocke, and I'll just use these two, although I think this theme moves into your other books as well. Both of these characters are complicated. They're crazy assassins, right? Like they've got a lot going on. I mean, Deadpool's more crazy than Psylocke. But when they get home to their romantic partner, be it Valentine or Grey Crow, they both just kind of get to shut off. They don't have to be anything for anybody, and they're finally themselves. And I'm watching that theme, and I think that's such a beautiful thing. Again, my show's named after the concept of found family, right? Like the ability to just exhale sometimes is so important. We could talk like this for the whole hour, but I'm gonna steer us in the direction of Shinobi Shaw for just a minute. It is 1991, and everything is changing at Marvel Comics. This is the era where Chris Claremont is leaving the books. X-Men Volume 2 got launched, so it's blue and gold, and all the teams except for Excalibur got kind of shuffled around, right? Peter David, who just passed, rest in peace, Peter, brought in all new characters into X-Factor, and we have Professor X returning to the X-Men in a prominent way to kind of match the cartoon energy that was getting ready to happen around that time as well. Now, it's interesting because we saw a lot of the old guard returning to previous places, but in the character of Shinobi Shaw, we have the opposite. When we first meet Shinobi, he's taking out the old guard. He is wiping out his dad. He's the character of privilege. His dad is Sebastian Shaw, the colonialist, the kind of horribly racist. He's the guy within the mutants that's turning on the mutants for profit, right? Like there's an uncomfortable industrialism to this character, but he's kind of magical as a supervillain at the same time. Shinobi is not a character we've ever seen before, but as he comes in, he's like, Dad, you're out of this. And I'm gonna cover the first appearance quickly, and then let's talk about your connection to this character. We first meet Shinobi in X-Factor 67. This is right when the Muir Island saga is wrapping up. Baby Cable's just been sent into the future. Old Cable is now leading the new mutants, changing them into X-Force, right? Like everything's shifting in this new kind of MTV generation. And right there, we see Sebastian Shaw in his Swiss chalet, learning someone has bought his company out from underneath him. Who could do such a thing? And in walks Shinobi saying, that would be me, Pops. Shinobi? For as often as you see me, I'm surprised you remember your own son's name. Shinobi is in a green trench coat with a pop collar, black tie, white shirt, blue vest, cinched pants at the waist, ankles that flare out in the middle. How could you do this to me, Shinobi? You've taken the lifeblood from my very veins. Do you have any idea what you've done? My companies were not solely a means of capital gain. They were the legitimate front I employed in my worldwide covert mutant operations. But more, I was born to dirt and I struggled to gold. All my life I've sought a position of power and stature, and you've taken that from me, you presumptuous, arrogant upstart. Remember that word in a minute. I would sooner see you dead than lose all I've worked toward. And he punches Shinobi again. Sebastian's powers, or he absorbs kinetic energy, turns it into physical strength. He throws Shinobi into the furniture. He takes him by the throat and squeezes, but surprise, Shinobi has mutant powers and his dad doesn't know. He says, "I can control my molecular, good Lord, my molecular density." So he can do all kinds of things with this. He can peek into the girl's showers room. He can take a crowbar to the chin. He can also induce massive coronary seizures. And those are all direct lines of dialogue. He's demonstrating what he can do with his powers. He drives his hand into Sebastian's chest. His father cries out in pain. Jeez, that must hurt. Speaking of which, do you think that since my powers are so much more like my uncle Leland's, that you're not my real daddy? Remember that for later as well. We'll talk all about that connection. Sebastian says, "I'll kill you for this." "I rather doubt that, Daddy-O." He blows up the entire building. His clothes are blown off. In the wreckage over Sebastian's corpse, Shinobi Shaw stands naked and says, "By the way, Dad, you're fired." That is an introduction to a character that I am not sure has ever been quite as magical as that very first time, but he is a ton of fun. Alyssa, where were you in 1991, and what are your thoughts on the introduction of Shinobi Shaw?
Oh God, I can't. I feel like I shouldn't say where I was in 1991, which makes it sound like I was in jail. But
I was 13. It was not a good year for me.
oh no, yeah, no. Being 13 is so hard. Do you remember what month this came out?
Ooh, I could look it up.
I'm so curious. I desperately want to know because I think Deadpool was possibly also 1991.
I think Deadpool was 89, but I'll check
Oh,
that
my
too.
bad, my
So it
bad.
says it was released in April 1991.
Okay.
And are you talking Deadpool's first appearance, or are you talking Deadpool number one?
I'm actually curious about both.
So Deadpool's first appearance, I think, in New Mutants number 98 in December 1990.
Okay,
And then
okay.
number Deadpool number one, the first single issue, was in 93.
This is gonna date me for sure. I wasn't alive yet. I was still, I guess, fetal to non-fetal. But what that, I mean, what that, but I, sorry, but what that means is that Shinobi and I don't exactly share a birthday, but it's pretty close, which I kind of love, honestly.
What are your thoughts on this first appearance, this kind of overthrow of his father through murder and explosion? He stands there naked while taunting his dad, who's dying at his feet.
It's perfect. I'm sorry. It's flawless. It's an incredible intro. Also, I hate Sebastian Shaw, so it makes me very happy. It's so dramatic. It's so showy. I love that. My editor, Darren Shen, says when I was talking about Psylocke and about plot and about emotion with my editor, one of the things he said was think melodrama. Think big, big emotions, big emotional events. I can't think of anything more melodramatic than rolling up on your dad, buying his company out from under his feet and exploding his house while taunting him naked. I mean, that's pretty great. I
By the
love
way,
that.
Dad, I'm a mutant. And also, are you my real dad?
Oh my God, that's so many bombshells. Oh my God, I adore Shinobi.
I'm excited to talk about this character. What is it about Sebastian Shaw that you hate? I mean, what's not to hate? But what is it that you hate?
I mean, there's so many things I hate. I mean, so I came in to, I think I encountered Shinobi for the first time while reading Jerry Duggan's Marauders, which is in retrospect low-key hilarious.
Which, by
But
the way, picks up on this initial line of dialogue about maybe Harry Leland is my real dad. No one's ever mentioned that again before Jerry Duggan brought that back.
it's so good. I love Marauders. I think it was like he was having Shinobi and Sebastian were having God like breakfast or just having a conversation. And I think Sebastian's like, "Are you gonna kill me?" And Shinobi's like, "I haven't decided yet." And I was like, "I love this son. He's perfect." Why do I hate Sebastian? What's not to hate about Sebastian? He's such an asshole. I didn't love him murdering. Was it Kitty Pride in Marauders? It's been a
Yeah,
hot
he
minute
killed Kitty,
since.
tossed her off the boat. Yep.
Horrendous. I was like,
And then she got her Killshaw knuckle tattoos.
yeah, I love her so much. I also love Emma. But also, let's talk really quickly about the whole like, I mean, the big thing is like, I also hate him because he's racist as hell. Like, let's talk about the whole like, I had a half-down Japanese son, and I named him the Japanese word for ninja. Like, are you kidding me? Bro, bro, come on, Ninja Shaw.
I was gonna bring up Shinobi Shaw as a name. It certainly sticks in your brain, but yeah, as like a white colonialist naming his half Japanese child Shinobi, that's crazy to me.
It is crazy. Like, Shinobi Shaw, is it a great name? Yes. Is it a horrendous name? Also, yes.
So that's one thing we don't know about this character. We've never learned who his mother is. I think his mother must be a Japanese woman. And then Harry Leland, also a mutant, dies with Nimrod, and Sebastian's left to raise Shinobi. So we don't exactly know what the complex origins of these characters are or how it all connects. But at some point, Sebastian got his hands on a Shinobi. But yeah, the word Shaw kind of means like thicket or woodland. It's got kind of these old American feels because, you know, Shaw descends from, I don't know, slave traders and colonialists. And then Shinobi, so like the ninja woodland, it's an odd name.
Yeah, it's a wild name. It's a wild name.
Had the Marvel trading cards as a teenager, and on the Shinobi Shaw card, if you read the power section, and if you remember, I worked on the handbooks years later, so I'd like file all this stuff away. Under his power section, it said that Shinobi had the power to control his molecular density, but I read it as molecular destiny. And I remember as a kid, as a teenager, it would bother me. Like I remember like for weeks and weeks being like, "What the fuck does that mean? Your molecular destiny?" I don't think it was until I was preparing for this show that I remembered that. I'm like, "Oh, it's density. That makes way more sense."
Yeah, I remember texting my editor as I was writing. I'm trying to remember what script it was. I was writing the Psylocke script where he shows up the first time, and I was like, I have this crazy idea, but I don't know if they're gonna let me do it. So I'd written so much like really clean, really fun, bright stuff in general for Marvel. Including I was writing Alligator Loki, which is all ages.
Yes.
So I was like, can I cut a guy in half with Shinobi, like his body? And my editor was like, good question, write it and we'll find out. And they let me get away with it. This guy who lunges at him with a knife and he moves his molecular density around,
We're his
the guy,
destiny.
or his destiny, the guy falls halfway through him and then he changes his density again to just cut the dude in half, which I am so surprised they let me get away with. And Vincenzo Caratu did an incredible job
Yeah.
with that. It's beautiful.
It's really interesting for me when I stack up similar power sets. If I put, you know, Jean and Emma and Kenan and Betsy all together, how does their telepathy work differently? That's always an interesting game for me to play. When we do phasing characters, Kitty phases and disrupts electronics. If you know the character Loa, she phases and whatever she passes through like discorporates behind her, right? The character Neophyte from the Acolytes, when he phases, he'll pop in one place and then like super speed to the other place where he's exiting. Shinobi has the phasing, but he also like has the density control. Like he can make things heavier or kind of snap things in half in that way, which is interesting as a counter to Sebastian's powers already. It's an impressive power set when it's used correctly.
Yeah, I love it. I think there's so much fun stuff you can do, and I just want to write more Shinobi. I love that man.
Shinobi shows up in Uncanny X-Men 281 through 283. He's in a quote, luxurious penthouse apartment. It is, for the first time of many, sitting in a Speedo on a red chair in a hot tub. And next to him is Trevor Fitzroy, who is so queer-coded as well, although he gives major incel from the future energy. He's a rough character too. Trevor Fitzroy is wearing all pink and white. Also, there's a butler serving them oysters and snails. They're surrounded by gorgeous women in bikinis and gorgeous men in Speedos. There's a whole crowd of them. And Shaw comments on how, quote, a king must not allow his energy level to diminish. Fitzroy wants him to join the upstarts, and Shinobi offers some of his father's sentinels because he has access to the company now, and his dad was making sentinels. And Fitzroy's like, no, actually, I have a bunch of sentinels from the future already. And those sentinels are sent to wipe out the Reavers and Donald Pierce in Australia. And these are the sentinels that end up killing the Hellions and putting Emma Frost into a coma. There's a whole story here. Fitzroy says, I have sentinels, Shinobi goes, yes, but they're smaller than mine. I remind you that I've already eliminated my own father in accordance with our master plan, and Sebastian Shaw was worth 50 times his weight in Reavers. So we learn these men are part of a group called the Upstarts, and basically it's kind of a rich, spoiled, bored society of like mutant heirs, if you will, who are just kind of creating chaos and murdering people for like metaphorical points that serve no purpose. Now, Jed MacKay recently brought the Upstarts back under Fitzroy's command. man. Now they're murdering people for profit on YouTube, basically, under Fitzwright.
So good.
But this group back then, it's just this kind of patch of really awful people. And everything is being run or tallied by a character named the Games Master, who's one of those mysterious telepaths. He's an omnipath. He seems to exist on kind of an overall kind of global level as an astral being. There's a few of these really strange characters that I want to sort out when I tell stories. I've got a lot of telepath and astral plane ideas in my own storytelling. So Shinobi Shaw comes back in 282 with Fitzroy, who has knocked Emma into a coma. He's also brings back the severed head of Donald Pierce, and he drops them into Shinobi's bedroom to show him what he's done. There was no reason to drip motor oil all over my very expensive satin sheets, says Shinobi. But then Fitzroy pulls out a knife and cuts the upstart ring off of Shinobi's finger in a story that doesn't kind of really play out. We jump to 283. Fitzroy goes after the X-Men, but Shinobi's agents capture him and put power blockers on him. Shinobi's in very tight pants. He's like trying to show off his ass for sure. And he laments that he might have bled to death if his sentinels hadn't reattached his finger. Okay. And then he tells Fitzroy that the Games Master has shut him down. Then Shinobi blows up Fitzroy's building. This isn't over yet, boy. It's very that energy. So the rivalry between these two is kind of the storyline that launches the Upstarts, which is a group that goes on to include some really terrible characters, including the Fenris twins, Fabian Cortez, the like Wormwood to Magneto in Avalon, and Sienna Blaze, who is the chaotic kind of Captain Planet fracking the ecosystem supervillain. Just a terrible group of people all around. And then the last member is Graydon Creed, who is the Donald Trump like child of Sabretooth and Mystique that ran for president. Just a truly abhorrible group of people. What are your thoughts on this upstart lineup?
Oh my God. I feel weird being like there's so much worse than current upstarts. I mean,
They
I think
really
ups
are. They actually genuinely are.
Yeah, no, I think it's such a gross and despicable group of villains that I think it's immediately compelling because you want to see these dudes eat shit.
Yeah, in 299, there's a note that says the Upstarts were founded as an escapist fair of the highest order, a brief escape or brief respite from the sheer tedium inherent in massive wealth and power. I, for one, say that if we're not going to enjoy our perpetual game of one-upmanship, then why bother? And that's a Shinobi Shaw quote.
Yes, it is.
Their motivations are ridiculous. You seem to take particular delight in this, like Shinobi sitting in a hot tub, like snorting cocaine with all the bikini models, like. What are your thoughts on this? It's like a recurring gag for this character. He wants nothing more than a hot bath and a bunch of like sexy people to feed him grapes.
I mean, that's pretty peak, honestly. So it's funny, I was talking to Jed McKay about Shinobi. I was also reading X-Men, of course,
I recently
and
recorded with Jed, and he also referenced this conversation with
oh
me.
my God, that's so funny. And so I was like, yeah, I'm thinking about using Shinobi, and he sends me that panel of Shinobi in the hot tub with Trevor, and he was like, if Trevor Fitzroy thinks you're too extra, then like you are hella extra. And I was like, this is so queer. This is a line that I think of all the time. And Jed was like, well, he's called Shinobi, not Shinobi. And I carry that deep in my heart.
We've actually never seen Shinobi interact sexually with anyone. What are your thoughts on his sexuality? Is he both men and women, or does he just like having pretty people around? Because I could even read this character as asexual if I'm honest.
Oh, that's true. I think this dude's bi as hell. Like, I 100%. I mean, I'm team bi, but I'm also biased. So, what can I say? No, I love him. I look at him like that's not a straight man. Like, not one bit.
I'm picturing like him putting his job ad out. Like, if you want to work for me, I'll pay you well, but you have to be under 8% body fat between the ages of 24 and 30, and be willing to like wait on me in a hot tub all day, every day in nothing but a bikini and never complain. Like that's the job.
Honestly, I can think of worse jobs. That's pretty good.
And there's something interesting about if we look at Sebastian Shaw, who's this for-profit military guy, right? Like or like industrial guy. What separates Shinobi out from his dad? Sebastian's clearly worse, but Shinobi's also terrible.
That's true. I mean, I'm thinking about it, and part of it honestly is I'm like, I hate Sebastian. That dude is so awful and he's so racist, and I don't think I can say that about Shinobi. But I also love that Shinobi is living his best awful life, you know? Like, dude is luxuriating, he is having fun with it, is I think the biggest thing. Like, when I think about Shaw, I'm like, Sebastian Shaw, I'm like, is that dude happy? Absolutely not.
Shinobi's
That
is
dude
more
is
the
not happy.
chaotic, evil, for-profit evil, where Sebastian is like profiting off the backs of slave labor kind of energy. It is different for sure. We get recurring gags of the Games Master likes to have like a telepathic conference with all the upstarts. So wherever they're at, they get yanked in, right? So with the Fenris twins, you always see them like laying next to each other in bikinis, implying a weird sexual relationship. Shinobi is almost always drinking alcohol or like sitting in his underwear. There's one scene in Uncanny where he's pulled into a meeting. He's literally pouring champagne, literally holding a rose in his teeth when they call him into the meeting. And you're like, what was happening here? In X-Men Volume 2, 21 through 23, which is Nicieza doing the big kind of revanche story, Shinobi is also involved here. So Shinobi's in his penthouse in Tokyo. There are scantily clad men and women everywhere. He's sitting in towel and he's meeting with a guy named Lord Nioran. Shinobi's drunk and he wants to the assassin Kwannon or excuse me, Kanon or revanche to kill the X-Men. This is when she is trapped in her British body and gets the legacy virus shortly after this. Betsy is occupying the Asian ninja body, wearing the bathing suit in combat everywhere. And Shinobi's trying to make a deal with Clan Yashida. He's like, I'll put them into new heights as long as you do this thing for me. He also meets with Matsuo Tsurayaba, who is, I've done a full episode on that guy. He is a crazy one. Shinobi's actually wearing clothes in issue 22, and he phases through the wall at a Japanese cocktail lounge to meet with Matsuo Tatsuo, Lord Tatsuo, who is the father of Opal Tanaka, like Iceman's girlfriend. I have an Opal Tanaka episode out there too. And Lord Nioran. He's called an irresponsible, fledgling young industrialist and accused of knowing Western ways. But Shinobi cares very little for traditional power lines. He's like, look, my mother remains separate from your maddening schemes. She suffered enough at the hands of my father. So again, we get reference to his mom being Japanese. Nioran punches him. Matsuo tells him, like, in your piquant little way, Shinobi, you are nothing more than a pampered child playing an adult game. And in 23, we see Shinobi in a bath with three women in bikinis washing him when Beast and Gambit attack, and they're asking about the upstarts. He says, it's just a small little club I dabble in. He stands up, he's naked. Beast looks at him and says, in your current state, small, little, and club are not words which should be combined in the same sentence, which is a really funny read.
That's so funny. Oh my God.
So when you consider Shinobi's connections to Kanon and Matsuo and Lord Nioran, I know you're getting ready to do some of this exploration in the upcoming Psylocke books, but do you have any comments on kind of that through line?
I think oh, this is so hard to say without spoiling anything. I think it's oh my God, I'm sorry. I'm like, I can't. There's so many things I can't say. But yes, we are gonna talk about it. I think Grey Crow's gonna learn a little bit more. There's so much I can't say. I think that history is definitely coming back. It is definitely a significant plot point and is definitely something that is haunting Psylocke as well throughout this whole arc.
So we're gonna see Shinobi some more, is what you're saying.
Oh yeah, of course we're gonna see Shinobi some more. I mean, I'm like, any chance I get to write Shinobi, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I don't know if that's a spoiler technically for anything, but if I'm pitching something,
Oh,
I'm
I
gonna
don't
be
think that's a
like,
spoiler. That's just a hint. Shinobi
I was like, that's just a fact. He's just like, can I have Shinobi?
shows up again in Super Soldiers number 7, where we learn he's producing genetically superior poppies for the drug trade. He's back in the Child's Play crossover, written by Nicieza, which is the X-Force New Mutants. And this is where the upstarts are tasked with like capturing former members of the New Mutants and Hellions. And Shinobi, again, robe drinking a bottle of wine. The games master's like, dude, you got to do more. Like, you killed your dad once. I'm not even sure he's dead. And you, if you want points and you want to stay part of this, then stop being so lazy. Like, you gotta be a better upstart, basically. And Shinobi says, I could literally rip the heart out of anyone I please, but I am a young man with more delicate interests in mind. But he does end up forcing kind of a confrontation between Vance Astrovic, Justice, and his own mother. If you recall, Vance, in a moment of self-defense, murdered his father, who was abusive, and ended up going to jail for it. So he gets like Justice and Firestar involved in employment, working against, in Shinobi's words, quote, the human cattle. We also get a huge moment for Shinobi in X-Men Volume 229, where he's decided to reactivate his father's interests in the Hellfire Club. So it's like a next generation, we're gonna go in the basement and dress in sexy clothes and manipulate the events of the world, right? Like my dad did for all those years. And he pulls Archangel and Psylocke in, and this is Betsy Braddock. They are both heirs to the club as well. And we also see Lady Tessa or Sage working with Shinobi here, but also kind of working against him. He has these two mutants captured, dressed in Hellfire outfits, and Shinobi references how he and Warren knew each other when they were kids because they would both like have to hang out in the Hellfire Club while their parents had secret meetings in the basement, basically. He asks them to join his inner circle, and he reveals he is a mutant. He calls himself a lady man, a ladies man, and then not a lady man, that's a different thing. A ladies man. Psylocke hits him with her psychic blade, and we see memories in Shinobi's mind of Sebastian screaming at him, hitting him, berating him, talking about how his mother coddled him. As the X-Men leave, the narration turns to Shinobi. Quote, "For years, he scampered about the halls of this mansion, always wanting to know what his father did in the basement below. Always thinking that since he could never find it anywhere else, the key to happiness had to be down there. Then he grew up. He opened the door and he walked the halls of the inner circle, the halls of power. But all Shinobi Shaw has found is a room that is as cold, as barren, and as empty as he is." Oh, harsh narrator, first of all. But we see
Damn.
Shinobi kind of referenced in trying to reclaim Sebastian's journey in some ways here. Do you have thoughts on his connections to the Hellfire Club?
I'm always interested in family legacy and how that affects people. You can't say, especially with that narrative, that there's no effect. I think his story is so interesting, not only in terms of inheritance, in this case taken by force, but also in how the Hellfire Club plays and his father's abuse plays into who he is now. I think we get a nice peek behind the like sexy playboy image that he projects. I think that abuse will destroy you. Everybody reacts differently to it, and I think
Turn me into a therapist.
turn me into a writer, so what can I say? So I think that you can draw a direct line in terms of, taking over the Hellfire Club, but also you can draw a direct line from his father's behavior while he was part of the Hellfire Club to who he became before he blew up that building with his dad inside to where he is now, whether or not it's seeking quote unquote empty pleasures. Although I'm kind of like, how empty is it really?
There are certainly increased motivations for murdering his dad added here, right? Like there's a lot going on. You can also see this character knows his time with the upstarts is coming to a close, which happens during that Child Play crossover. He brings Justice in as his agent and has a quote where he's like, "I always love seeing the middle class move up." A few issues later, when the X-Men attack him in it's X-Force 33, he's in a bath and he literally says to them, "Why is it that all you X groups seem bent on breaking into my home every time I'm in the bath? Dude, when are you not in the bath? That's my question." But when he betrays the upstarts, he has no choice but to leave the group, which really launches him into this kind of brief era in the mid-90s of trying to make the Hellfire Club happen. In X-Men Annual 3, he lures Storm into the Hellfire Club, sedates her with some roses that he sent to her, and then like has another mutant kind of change her mind to so that she'll see him in a sympathetic light and join with him. He's really trying hard to convince her. He says to her, "I've now set my life on a shining path to lead human and mutant kind together in peace toward the new millennium, and I want you at my right hand as I do so." And she says, "The transition from renegade to messiah is a little hard to accept, Shinobi, but even notes like the honey almost drips from your tug." So he's like, we can change the world, we can work together, we can take over, we can end war, poverty, famine, we can make it work for mutants, but he's drugging her, so that's not great. He's also working with Kandra, the crazy external lady. And there's a new inner circle introduced as his Hellfire Club, who are not often used. One of them is Benedict Kine, who can manipulate your nervous system. One is Reva Page, who has sonics that can alter your brain. And one is Benazir Kaur, who speeds diseases up, basically.
Oh my
So
God.
Storm kicks all their asses. And then we see these characters back in Night Thrasher, where Shinobi has some dealings with Duane Taylor. We see him in Generation X Annual 95, where Emma's little sister Cordelia is trying to get into the Hellfire Club. We see them in Spider-Man Team Up Number One, where there's another plot for Shinobi's Hellfire Club because they are challenging his rule. And in this case, he, in order to prove his superiority, he sends some assassins after J. Jonah Jameson, of all people. So the X-Men and Spider-Man attack. And, Shinobi gets out of it for sure. But this is where he learns Tessa's working against him. He's also in Excalibur 96. There's another Hellfire Club story involving Brian Braddock. And we meet his aide Marine, who just wears lingerie. So again, it's very his dad coded. My assistant must dress dress sexy. The last time we see him is in X-Force 62, where he learns that Sebastian is still alive. So he hires two bodyguards. We've never seen these characters ever again, but I loved them. One is Clear Cut, who's this cool-looking swordsman, and one is Mind Meld, who is looks like a transgender character. They have blue skin, and their power is to like switch bodies and minds. So like this character could like swap Betsy and Cannon back, like just like trade their minds into different bodies, right? Like that's the power. So this happens with X-Force. Shinobi hires a guy named Dr. Graves to experiment on Karma's little missing siblings, Leong and Naga, and he wants to remove their mutant powers so that he can learn how to transfer them to humans. This is the most villainy thing I think he's done to this point. X-Force attacks, Spiral shows up, and Shinobi sells the kids to Spiral, where they get taken to the body shop and turned into crazy assassins, and that's followed up in on a different story. Shinobi also kills the doctor that he had hired before getting his ass kicked, and then boom boom blows his house up. So that's kind of the end of his Hellfire Club era before we get to the Krakoa era just before. Do you have any thoughts on Shinobi in this era of the books?
Dude keeps blowing up passes. I
Well,
mean,
this time it was boom
okay, that's fair. That's
boom.
fair.
I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks, I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Best Seller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
I was gonna say, like, I guess if you're gonna go out in style, then why not blow up a house? That's gonna sound really bad out of context, but I don't know. I mean, I think that, I mean, that's solid evil. That is solid evil. I have a very soft spot for Karma, especially after my friend Trung wrote this beautiful Karma like
Trung has become
story.
one of my favorite people. We text all the time. I have
Oh!
Trung, and Trung came back and did an episode with me on Karma's evil uncle.
Oh my God. Oh
Yeah,
my God.
Trung's amazing. I didn't know you guys knew each other.
Yeah, no, I love Trung. It's funny, when I was talking about making bracelets, one of the things we do is I'll call Trung and we'll like talk shop and I'll make bracelets. So it's I adore Trung in a very different way that I adore Shinobi. And I think that yeah, no, this is twisted, this is bad shit. But I also think it's an interesting chapter in his history as a character.
So Shinobi dies off panel. Sebastian comes back and kills him. And then he's resurrected by Celine during that crazy Necrotia event, along with Harry Leland. they both attack Sebastian Shaw and Donald Pierce together. And we also get to see Shinobi strangle Sebastian in this arc while Danger cuts off Shinobi's arms. But there's like a TO virus. Sebastian punches Shinobi and calls him a disappointment. And then in the quote, Last Days of Mutants, Matt Rosenberg did that series right before Krakoa, where he just blew everything X-Men up to pieces. We learn that Emma Frost is like manipulating minds and the Office of National Emergency are here. So there's like a one-page thing where she reunites the upstarts and makes them kill the nasty boys and fight the X-Men. And Shinobi, rather than be mind controlled, this is what happened. He puts his hand in his own brain and kills himself rather than submit to her control. So he's died a second time here, Necrosha, and then his death before his resurrection on Krakoa. Any thoughts on the untimely deaths of Shinobi Shaw?
That's so funny. I love that you're like, hey, do you have any thoughts about this dude beefing it? I mean, I have massive respect for just her hand in head. I'd rather die. I love a character who says no in the most like balls to the wall kind of way. I mean, I
I
think
mean, he
that
doesn't like
that's.
telepaths, but also Emma worked with his dad, right? Like, rather than your dad murdered me, and now rather than be controlled by you, I'd rather die. That's an interesting narrative already.
Yeah, for sure.
And then we have Jerry Duggan. Shinobi is resurrected on Krakoa. Sebastian tries to like convince him because Shinobi's got some brain damage or like his memory's been altered. He's like, these mean evil X-Men killed me. It was Kate Pryde and Emma Frost specifically Shinobi. And Shinobi is like, wait a minute, wasn't that me that killed you? We've never quite seen that followed up on. But Sebastian brings Shinobi in and makes him the Red Bishop of the new Hellfire Trading Company, which at the time is responsible for like helping administer the Krakoan drugs to places around the world and to aid mutant refugees. Shinobi also brings Fenris in as like his little agents. They're his little, I don't know, war crime buddies. I don't like them. And then Harry Leland comes back. Harry Leland is a character a lot of people are super fond of. He's like the reasonable member of the original Inner Circle, a mutant with density control powers, and it turns out he is Shinobi's real father. Sebastian says in Marauders 26, Shinobi, your mother was a friend to both Harry and I. She wrote about money for a baby, saying he belonged to one of us. I thought I was doing the right thing, taking you in as my own, but what did I know of fatherhood? It was disastrous for both of us, I suppose, especially you. Harry, meet your bastard, Shinobi. And Harry hugs Shinobi, who is so uncomfortable. We see Shinobi working in Madripoor a little bit, and that's the end of him in the Krakoan era, except he learns his dad is working with Orcus. So again, fuck Sebastian Shaw. Do you have any thoughts on the Marauder stuff before we jump to Psylocke to conclude?
I mean, I'm a big Marauders fan. I'm a big Jerry fan. And I don't know. I love baby daddy drama. I one of the things I really love about that particular moment where it's like, surprise, here's your bastard son, is that Leland's like, yeah, hell yeah, which is, I'm sure, not the reaction that Sebastian was hoping for. And I think also with Shinobi growing up with Sebastian, having a dad who is, you know, who's willing to also literally embrace him has got to be one of the most scary things in the world. Oh, sorry about that beep.
Oh,
It's
and
got to
I
be
can
one of the
hear
most okay, that's good. But it's got to be one of the most scary things in the world, especially if you grow up knowing that family is a source of danger. You have been abused by your family. Having suddenly being like, here's additional family and they want to love you is something that you wouldn't necessarily trust. It is something that is very scary. So I love this part of Shinobi.
Jerry's Marauders really expands the cast, and I love when writers can just kind of tie in X-Men continuity, and we just get to enjoy it as fans, right? Christian Frost is used here, Callisto. Like, there's so many healing moments for characters. Even Mask, that awful character from the Morlocks, is in here. Which brings us up to Shinobi post-Krakoa, kind of back to his old ways. He's of a certain age now, right? He's a little older. He's rediscovering his love of hot tubs and anarchy, I suppose. The incredible writer Alyssa Wong uses them in the new Psylocke volume. Here's a quote from Alyssa as narrator. Shinobi Shaw, mutant upstart, corporate demon, consummate hedonist. His family fortune is only matched by his ambition. Don't let the pretty face fool you. That's just another weapon in his arsenal. So Alyssa, perhaps my most important question today, fuck, marry, kill, a mutant upstart, a corporate demon, and a consummate hedonist.
Oh my God, you can't do this to me. Okay, fuck me, kill. Hit me with it again.
The three parts of Shinobi Shaw.
Okay, kill corporate.
I mean, we fucked the hedonist, right? Like,
I think so. So, I think so. I feel like marrying a hedonist can go either way, especially if they have a lot of money. But I feel like you're gonna hit an age where you're like, I don't know if my, I don't, well, if you're lucky, you'll hit an age where you're like, I don't know if my joints are gonna let me get into this hot tub anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like fuck the upstart because because it's dangerous, but marry the hedonist because you'll have a lifetime supply of oysters. So, that's.
And hot tubs. So I love when a writer smartly shows us what matters about a character by telling the story about the character rather than just putting it on the page. You are exploring kind of a complete blank slate when it comes to Kenon. We have some stuff with her later adult life as a ninja assassin and all the crazy with Matsuo, but you're showing us images of her childhood where she is this kind of assassin in training, which is very Black Widow, right? Black Widow in the Red Ring, except it's a Kenon with the hand, having to make really difficult decisions. And when you show Psylocke in the modern era, she's all action. She is a soldier. She's an assassin. She can't sit still. Cyclops has to suspend her from the team to take a vacation. But her soft spot is mutant kids. And we get to see that very clearly. So when Shinobi learns of AIM auctioning off mutant children, he puts out a direct tip to Psylocke to rescue them. Psylocke attacks Shinobi in his hot tub. She demands that he join her in saving some of these kids. So they go to a place called the Cleaver Club, which is an underground place where rich people are betting on kids in a combat arena with truly terrible human trafficking, awful. Shinobi kicks ass. He's manipulating his density. He is cutting people in half. He crushes a hand. Psylocke has to rescue the kids. And then we get Shinobi telling about his childhood friendship question mark with a very creepy kid named Ty Hanover, who becomes a really creepy supervillain called the Taxologist. Do you want to talk about your creation of the Taxologist and how this story uniquely pushes what you're trying to do with Psylocke?
When I was thinking about what kind of villain I wanted to build for Psylocke, by Psylocke I mean both Kenon, who obviously is my girl, but also Betsy. I was like, who is a good fit for her? And I thought rather than having a combat-oriented villain, because she is this peak assassin, somebody like a high-profile stalker, somebody who claims to know her and her past better than she does, when that's already a source of discomfort and I would say insecurity for her, is really cool. So more of an emotional villain, as well as a villain for sure.
We know your love of body horror. We got to talk about that when I had you on the show. This man pins Psylocke to the wall like she's a bug in his collection. This, wow.
So his whole thing is he's like, I collect genetic anomalies because I have this very rare genetic condition, and my obsession started when I just felt so alone. I think feeling alone is actually a big theme in this book in general. So he was like, oh, this creature is like me. And whether that's a rabbit with the what is it, papillomavirus, that makes them grow keratin out of their faces, which is like the OG origin of the jackalope, or like sheep born with two heads. Because he's got all this family money, but he's a very isolated child, he starts collecting these things and eventually builds his museum full of all kinds of these very natural genetic rarities. And so when he sees Psylocke, he learns about her whole like two in one Betsy Cannon like body switch stuff, and he's like, that is fascinating, and that makes you a one of a kind specimen. He becomes obsessed. And so when Cannon breaks into his mansion, she finds this horrifying museum with like her old costumes, like a bunch of pieces of memorabilia from her past. And he does eventually catch her and pin her to like a butterfly pork board. It is gross, but I love the taxonomist, because he's just a guy. He's a guy with money, right? And if you want a super villain, there's a guy with, you don't get much bigger than a guy with money. But that's the Shinobi connection, being a kid whose parents are like, being a kid whose dad and like family is connected somehow to Ty Hanover's family, and being these weird, like awkward, rich kids, and having that uneven relationship
But yet
where.
another example, like Hellfire Club wise, of these horrible parents raising entitled children who go on to do horrible things, right? It's interesting when you look at Shinobi's character connections in a lot of different ways. The taxonomist, the Hellfire Club, Betsy Braddock, her parents were part of the Hellfire Club, right? And her dad was a crazy scientist also. But Kanon, who's kind of largely separate from that, she's from the hand. Her connections come from like her big trauma. I know you're working in these stories about her childhood friend Mitsuki coming back. You're also working in these, she's like haunted by her memories. Her trauma has taken like a literal psychic form while she's also handling the memories of her daughter that she lost, which was explored in the early part of Krakoa in the Fallen Angels series. Shinobi also sold children to Spiral, who was involved in Kanon's transformation as well. There's some really interesting, painful connections between these two, but it sounds like they're gonna kind of end as allies, which is interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's messy. And I think if there's one thing that I think Canon can understand, it's having a past that you're not proud of. I think that Shinobi, as he is now, would not be proud of that. I don't think he would ever apologize for it, but I don't think it's what he would consider his best moment. I mean, we've talked so much about childhood trauma here, and that's a lot of what this book is about in general. There is a bit in, I'm trying to remember which episode, sorry, I'm trying to remember which issue, but there's a bit where Shinobi and Grey Crow start to go toe to toe. Shinobi's like consummate flirt, also huge asshole. He's like, "Oh, you didn't tell her about me," or sorry, "She didn't tell you about me, did she?" And that magical night we spent together, the birth of Krakoa. So they did hook up,
Shinobi and Grey
and
Crow hooked up.
oh, if only. No. Shinobi and Kanan
I
hook
know, I'm
up.
teasing.
I mean, listen, I was like, I want tension everywhere. I want, like, if Shinobi shows up on the page, I want everybody to want him, even if they hate themselves for wanting him. I think, and then,
Shinobi's a guy you fuck, not a guy you date.
yeah. And I think the best part is he knows that. He's like, "I'm here to have a good time, not a long time." And he feels like, to me, like somebody who's like, "I have this much life in me. I don't know how long it's gonna last, but I'm gonna have the best time possible."
Also, if I die, I've been resurrected twice already.
Right.
One of the interesting things for me with Shinobi, and we won't take time to dive deep into this, is like what he considers morally over the line. Like his father's actions, Sebastian's actions, clearly over the line. But like childhood, kids getting sold to AIM over the line. But there was a certain point where he also sold kids. It'd be interesting to, if he becomes like a featured character somewhere on a consistent basis, to kind of explore his thoughts about his history. I also really want to learn more about his mom, about his connections with Harry after Krakoa and what that looks like, if there's any. Maybe he's just like, leave me alone, man. You don't know me. Really, really interesting character, and I'm excited to see what you continue to do with him. As we're wrapping up our conversation, Alyssa, what thoughts show up in your mind as we kind of have this focused discussion about a character that no many people give a lot of thought to, Shinobi Shaw.
Shinobi Shaw. Well, one thing that I really love about him is that he's mixed, like he's mixed race, and so am I. So I was instantly like, "That's my boy." Yeah, he's awful, but that's my boy. And I love that he doesn't apologize for that, because I feel like you get that a lot of times in, that's a whole ass trope, but you get that a lot of times with mixed race characters where like, "I'm torn between worlds and I have a lot of guilt and I don't know who I am." I'm like, this guy's like, "I know who I am and I simply don't give a shit. I'm too busy out here having a great time." I think that he is so much fun because he's absolutely out for himself. And I love to write characters who are out for themselves. I think, yeah, he's like, "This is over the line," but also like the child trafficking in the Psylocke book, he's like, "This is out of line, but also I don't want to deal with it, so you go deal with it." Psylocke's like, "You're coming with me." So the reason he goes with her is because of her, not necessarily the kids. And I think that's really interesting as well.
Right. Yeah, I gave the warning and that's all I needed to do until Psylocke shows up to force him. Yeah, that's interesting on its own. I like him. I like his kind of moral complexity, and I like that he's kind of unrepentant. He's a fun villain. Sebastian Shaw is also a fun villain, but a horrible, horrible person. Shinobi has some interesting redemptive qualities. Here's the final thing I'll share. This was unsolicited, but back when I worked on the Marvel handbooks, I really wanted to transition into writing comics full time. This is right before I came out and my life kind of capsized for a little while, but I wrote four original books and pitched them to Marvel editors without being asked. And one of the books that I wrote, this was in like 2010, was a book called Dark X-Men, before Dark X-Men was a thing, because the Dark Avengers were such a big deal around that time. It was in the X-Men Utopia era, and I wrote Shinobi Shaw leading a team of mutant villains, kind of on a they're pretending to be heroes arc. Necra was on his team, Toad was on his team. It was really fun writing this guy and his ability to control his molecular destiny.
Ha ha ha.
I really enjoy this character, and it was really fun to explore this. Early invitation, and you can say no, and I'll delete it if you want. But I would love to have you and Trung on together, and we could talk about Susan Hatchie, who's Karma's like rich entitled evil sister. That would be a lot of fun.
Oh, I would love that. That'd be so much fun.
Maybe later this summer. That would be really fun to have the two of you on together. While we were chatting here, I messaged Trung and I said, or I texted Trung and said, I'm recording with Alyssa Wong. We're talking about how great you are. And he replied with OMG, aw. So, hey, Trung, we love you.
I love you, Trung. My angel.
Alyssa, what a genuine joy. It's such an honor to have your time today. I'm so appreciative. I don't know if you're doing any cons upcoming. We're going to put this out at the end of June. Where can people find you online? And is there anything you want to plug as far as appearances or books outside of course, your amazing work on Psylocke coming up this summer?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm gonna be at GalaxyCon Raleigh, and I think this summer. I don't think I'm doing any other cons. I did a bunch of cons last year, and they were so fun, and I love them so much. But also, I'm like, I need to get writing. So much stuff I gotta
Cons are
write.
exhausting. Yeah, they really are tiring. I like the small cons. I really love FlameCon. I really love the Uncanny Experience. If you can go to the Uncanny Experience sometime, it's my favorite con ever. It's X-Men focused, it's small, it's wonderful, it's super queer focused. You should certainly come
Oh,
here.
that sounds so fun. I mean, what you said about Leah being nervous about interacting with X fans, I definitely felt that because, the X men are a really big deal. And when I said yes to writing the Psylocke book, I was really nervous. I was like, are people going to be really mad at me? Are they going to be mean? And everybody that I've talked to has been so kind and just excited. I'm very grateful for that. So, Team Psylocke, thank you very much.
I think you're a phenomenal talent. I'll follow you anywhere. And it's such an honor to know you personally, Alyssa. Thank you so much. Everybody listening, you can follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. Alyssa, you're welcome to follow me if you'd like.
Thank
If you want
you.
to watch for the show in July on the show, we're doing a full month dedicated to the character Pyotr Rasputin or Colossus. Every episode
Ooh.
out on the Patreon and the main show will be celebrating Colossus. So on the main show, our next episode will be a script reading of X-Men number 97, including an interview with the incredible and delightful Patty Cockrum, the widow of Dave Cockrum. And Patty's just the loveliest. She's 83 and blind and tells so many hilarious fucking stories. It's really great, including their first meeting where she saw Dave in the Marvel offices at the copier, walked up behind him and slapped his ass and said, "Nice ass." And that's how they first met.
Oh my God! So funny. That's so funny.
And then over on the Patreon, you can watch for an episode all about Mikhail Rasputin with my friends Mike Siriaco and Michael Solis. So thank you everybody for listening. Thank you so much to Alyssa for being on the show. We will see you all back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon channel. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. The Thule Society, also called the Thule Gesellschaft, was founded in Munich in 1918, though its roots go back earlier in folk nationalist and occultist currents in Germany and Austria. It emerged from the Germanen Norden, a secret nationalist society, via the splinter group led by Rudolf von Sebottendorf, who styled himself the Baron von Sebottendorf, and art student Walter Nauhaus. The Thule Society claimed mythic origins in the concept of Thule, or Ultima Thule, a legendary northern land thought in Ariosophic circles to have been the ancient homeland of the Aryan race. Their ideology mixed German nationalism, anti-Semitism, mythic racial theory, and occult or pseudoscientific speculation, for example, runes, Aryan prehistory, and mystical geography. And we'll likely end up talking about some of those things in future anecdotes on the show. Some of the weirdest elements adopted by the Nazis came via these Thule Society and related occult nationalist streams and thought patterns. The use of symbols like the swastika, which was already part of the broader Aryan Völkisch symbolism, was retasked by these groups as sacred emblems pointing to racial purity and cosmic destiny. Mythic or semi-mythic claims about lost northern lands lands like Hyperborea, Thule, Atlantis, about Aryan super origins, about mystical blood and soil like the Blut and Boden, all found reinforcement in Thule-linked apocryphal lore. That said, many of the occult claims about ritual magic, secret initiations, or supernatural conspiracies are either exaggerated, speculative, or post-war myth-making. The historical record supports political activism, cultural nationalism, racism, but has less concrete evidence for widespread magical rites or occult conspiracies at the level sometimes claimed. But boy, do we see a lot of them in our comic books. After World War I and the collapse of Imperial Germany, the Thule Society played a key role in political agitation in the Bavaria area, opposing socialism, communism, and Jewish influence, incubating early nationalist anti-Semitic groups, and having members or associates who would later rise in the Nazi movement. However, its direct institutional power waned as the Nazi Party gained dominance in the 1920s. It was never formally part of any Nazi structure, and Hitler himself probably never attended its meetings. After the Nazis came to power, many such occult or volkish groups were sidelined or absorbed, and the Thule Society in modern culture kind of faded away. But no surprise, in recent decades, there's been a resurfacing or fascination with the Thule Society in fringe ideologies, conspiracy theories, neo-Nazi, and white supremacist circles. In myths, lost Aryan homelands, occult secret societies, sacred symbols are recycled, and online and extremist propaganda. Also, groups like the White Order of the Thule in the US, which arose in the 1990s, explicitly evoke the name, aiming to revive or adapt some of the Aryan supremacist and occult ideas. These revivals tend to be more symbolic and conspiratorial than the original's mixture of cultural nationalism, political activism, and esotericism. They show how once obscure occult myth can feed modern extremist identity, especially in digital subcultures. All right, now we're going to jump into the world of Captain America 445 through 448. Captain America died, except he didn't, and now a full blood transfusion has saved his life, resetting the super soldier serum in its optimum state, giving him the youthful Olympian body he's accustomed to. And the man who provided the blood transfusion, why, the Red Skull, who was living in a clone body of Captain America. He's all dressed in black and silver here. How does it feel to discover you owe your life to a man you've hated for half a century, he says. Cap punches him in the face. Red Skull bitch slaps him. We will never survive, Rogers, if you do not choose your battles more carefully than this. My mind is my own, but my body was cloned from yours. Ordinarily, I am at least your physical equal. And since you are apparently still healing and not up to prime, I am your better, your master. You will survive only by staying aware of that fact. And the Red Skull's working with Sharon Carter. It's confusing. He saved Steve because he needs Captain America to defeat a mutual foe called the Kubikult, Kubekult. There's a group of neo-Nazis who want to free Adolf Hitler's consciousness from the cosmic cube that the Red Skull once trapped him in. They have formed the New World Reich, and they've begun transforming entire military units into, well, Nazi units, with the ultimate goal of bringing Hitler back. Captain America, Sharon Carter are working with the Red Skull to get the cube out of their hands, and then Cap saves the life of the Red Skull in a key moment. But the Red Skull gets the cube, and he traps Captain America inside it, and then Steve begins living out his earliest memories as a hero. How utterly perfect! My ultimate plan, Rogers, and you walked right into it almost literally the moment I made you an unwitting prisoner of the cosmic cube. You are far from alone within its six walls. Now that the Kubikult has unleashed its limitless power, the mad genie stirs restlessly inside the bottle. The mind of Hitler, held captive inside, yearns to take charge of the cube and change the world into one I have no hope of ever ruling. Hitler was the foe Captain America was first forged to defeat. Why else would I ally myself with my greatest enemy? When Sharon Carter questioned the Red Skull, he hit her across the face, but soldiers attacked. The Skull found the cube powerless against them, leaving Sharon to protect him until the Skull used weaponry to burn the soldiers alive. He punched Sharon again. He called her a cow. Before Cap freed himself from the cube and beat the shit out of the Skull, threatening to behead him with his shield, in a really jarring image, actually. But instead, somehow, he cut off the Skull's arm, because he threw his shield, which I don't think that's how his shield works. Anyway, the skull disappears inside the cosmic cube itself. We'll pick that story up next time. That was a lot, and I know my friend Ladra Rinsler, who's joining me today, is thinking, what the fuck did I sign up for? Ladra, welcome. Are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
I texted you earlier. I think the Red Skull is the second best villain with a Red Skull after his own daughter, Sin. That's my order right there. Sin and then Red Skull. I am not a Captain America guy. You reached out and were like, hey, do you want to talk about the Red Skull? There's these four issues of Captain America. And I was like, I will do this for Chad. I will fall on the sword. And I loved these issues. They were actually really fun. I was shocked. Shocked that these were so good. Mark Waid, who knew?
Yeah, Mark Waid, who took over the run right after Mark Gruenwald died. We've been covering those stories slowly on my show over time as we handle the Red Skull stories in consecutive order.
Yeah, so the Cubicult, I mean, it is scary. So I think people who are familiar with my work know that I'm a long-term Buddhist teacher and author, but I heritage-wise, my parents were both Jewish before they began studying Buddhism, and their parents were Jewish. And so it was like I was raised just close enough to the Holocaust that my mother's mother imparted so deeply into my mom that they were coming back. That my mother always says to this day, everything's fine, but just remember you're Jewish because the Nazis are going to come back. And it's like there's something just intergenerational trauma-wise that just says anytime you see something like this, this feels very fucking real. Like there is always going to be some group out there, and sometimes they're more empowered by political rhetoric than others. Not going to go down this rabbit hole right now, but you understand what I mean. To actually like carry on the idea of white supremacy. So it's fucking scary to see just how accurate this feels. I mean, it's weird. They're weird dudes, but they don't seem so bizarre that they couldn't actually just exist as something in our world.
So let's open with where I started the show, the Thule Society. I don't know if this is an area of research you are at all familiar with.
I
There's a
know.
literal Thule Society that exists within Marvel Comics, and there are branches of the Thule Society, which is kind of the mystical elements of Aryanism and the way that, I don't know, we see kind of this like weird, like anti-vaxxer culture these days, and these like odd conspiracy elevations about Democrats and, I don't know, eating babies in pizza ovens or, whatever. Like this like idea of like really fringe, insane ideas gaining traction. There's
Yes.
an established history of that, and many people willing to believe anything that makes them feel special. So we compare that to the Cubicult, this kind of modern society who are latching onto the old ideas of Hitler wanting to bring him back. It's jarring, and then you compare it to the real world, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it feels like, the idea of keeping the dream alive is something we talk a lot about in the X-Men side of things, right? And here, it's like the perverted inverse of this. It's like we're keeping the dream alive, but the dream is vengeful hatred and, anti-Semitism, or it's anti-everyone, really. It's the anti-global majority. So it's a fucking bizarre story. Like, why does Sharon Carter get roped into any of this?
So
Who
Sharon
knows?
at this time has been believed to be dead for a long time,
Right? Yes.
undercover. There's a lot going on. But the story is that she's working with the Red Skull to revive Cap because they need his help to stop the Hitler-run Cubicult from destroying the planet. That's the
Sure.
premise. This is a
Right.
little bit, what a cruel fucking thing to do to Steve Rogers. This is a little bit like Sabretooth bringing Wolverine back with his own blood just so he can hunt him down and kill him again. Like, just,
Yeah.
it's a rough, like, I'm better than you are, ha ha. It's
It's, yeah, the whole, like, the Red Skull of it all is so fucking bizarre that his master plan is, hey, first of all, as you noted, I'm you, I'm your body with my mind, and you're not at full strength, and I can beat the shit out of you. Also, I need your help, so you should help me. And also, I'm going to take advantage of your good nature, and then I'm going to imprison you in a cosmic cube, and I'm going to try and make you fight Hitler by rewriting your history. I mean, that's essentially what he does throughout this arc of, like, he brings back Bucky, he brings back, Steve Rogers' mom, he makes Sharon Carter her previous self. And brings back
And
all the
this
things.
is the reality Steve's living within the cube, everybody.
Yes, thank you. That this is all happening within the cube. He saves the Professor Erskine, who, died right after he made the super soldier serum. He does all of the things right, and he gets to live in this perfect reality in the cosmic cube. And then his subconscious basically says, this isn't real. This isn't right. And whatever you find behind that door, it's not. not actually going to be Hitler. You need, the real threat is the present day version of carrying on this dream, which in this case is the Red Skull. And we see Captain America burst out of the cosmic cube to fight the Red Skull at the very end. Do you think Hitler was behind that door?
That's complicated because Hitler has multiple clones in the Marvel Universe. He's the,
right,
he's the,
sure,
hate monger. But there's a certain point where, you know how like Magneto and Xavier have like a rage baby that's Onslaught?
Yes, I do.
The Red Skull
and we all had to suffer that, yeah.
The Red Skull and like Hitler have a rage baby that's like the hate monger. It's like a psychic entity that just gets like summoned and turns people into Nazis. It's so Hitler's kind of out there all the time. There's all these
all the time. Cool. He's
the backdrop of the Marvel Universe in an odd way. We have a couple really jarring images. One of them being Cap severing the Red Skull's arm with his shield, which I don't know how that fucking works. It's not a razor blade. And then the image of Cap like popping his head up against the Red Skull's, or his shield up against the Red Skull's head,
yeah,
like he's gonna cut his head off. Jarring, but it like shows you how far you've pushed Cap. I don't know. It's intense.
It is. There's two things here. So it's like Steve Rogers is apparently being driven to murder by basically being given a reality where everything went well for him. So I don't quite understand, but like, I think there is something of realizing, oh, the present day version of the thing that I've been fighting my entire life is standing right on the other side of that door, and he just goes off. Why he goes off more this time than any other time to the Red Skull, I do not know. He also, as he cuts off the Red Skull's arm with a shield, he hits the cosmic cube, and that's what actually, there's a giant skatow, a full page spread of just magical whatever cosmic energy the cosmic cube is, and then they're both gone.
The Red Skull like lives in the cosmic cube for a while and then like,
right,
absorbs its energy, and then Kang the Conqueror gets involved. We'll get there, just stay tuned everybody.
Yeah, stay tuned everybody. But it's just the whole thing of like, this is a really powerful shield. It can cut someone's arm off and it can destroy a cosmic cube. It's sort of like, you know, you need either like a Jean Grey or a Scarlet Witch or just like capped shield. Sure, any of those can hurt this, you know, massive energy source, reality bending thing of a cosmic cube.
Yeah,
cool.
Everyone that I've had on the show thus far for these conversations has had an impact in their life from World War II and is feeling impacted in modern day America. So I really appreciate you sharing your family story, Lodro. That was nice to hear and connect with you over. How you doing these days as a parent, as a host, as a wellness practitioner?
Yeah, you know, I will say this, you know, because I overshared about the sort of epigenetic sort of trauma of the Holocaust, that at this point it feels like, you know, I think a lot of us parents are dedicated to sort of reparenting. And so I've been taking, even though, you know, again, primarily I teach Buddhism and, you know, do Buddhist things, I also have started taking my daughter to like the children's program at the local temple, just so that, you know, we can have like a new education together and she can be exposed to things that are not through this lens of trauma. And it's really funny because, you know, she's two. So I'm like, oh, can you explain the story of Purim to my daughter, but also like me, because I never really got the full story. It's really like fun to relearn and reconnect to that heritage without a lot of the baggage. And of course, we are in the backdrop of, you know, I live in upstate New York. This is a very mixed place that I live in terms of ideology. And, you know, some cubicle people could be like down the street from me for all I know. You know, there is one point where the police showed up at my door because they perceived a threat to the Easter celebration here in town, and it was just the Jews that actually they showed up at their door, and that is pretty horrible. They got an earful down the road, but like
most people I'm talking to are going through this kind of sensation that the circles are growing smaller, right? Like I know more people being affected. I'm seeing more examples of it in my day-to-day life, and that's scary in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something about being in a small town like mine where it's like there's no avoiding me, and there's no me avoiding people with very different ideologies. So we have to be in conversation. And I think that's the only way that healing actually takes place, that we break out of those bubbles. And I mean, we used to say like reach across the aisle, but I would just say like, just have normal conversations, humanize one another and not villainize one another. And I think that's it's just a powerful thing that has to happen one by one in these small communities that we all live in. And gradually, I think that can have a larger ripple effect and sort of decrease the hatred and some of the things that we actually see that are pretty damn scary that are in this comic book from back when.
Well, whether we are talking about Tusk or the Sauron spit roast or the Cube Cult, I'm always happy to hang out with you, my friend. I am grateful for your intelligence and your light.
And if anyone's like, wow, this was pretty serious, a lot about like, you know, white supremacy and all that, go back to our previous work together. As you just said, you know, Chad came on my show for a great episode of X-Men Horoscopes called The Spit Roast of Sauron, which is just dumb.
It's pretty
And he
fun.
had me on to talk about Tusk, and I'm sure that I would have to give it a re-listen, but I'm sure it's a very highbrow conversation about the Dark Rider Tusk. So those are, if you want more fun stuff from us, you know, there's places to find it.
I look
Thanks
forward
for
to
having
hanging out
me.
again and again. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves. We will see you all back here next week. Bye-bye.